It is June 15th, and this is Rabbi Adler Shior.
Boketov. Okay, a fine time to turn down the cell phones. Was anybody sitting here, was that my talk in English on Shavuos night at 10:30 to the Shir Chadash group? Good, because I want to repeat something. You missed something, but all right. But I'm going to give you just a short synopsis. A short synopsis. Because the shir was entitled From Moses Until Charlton Heston. Moses, Charlton Heston was the actor in 1956 film The Ten Commandments. So he was the Moshe Rabbeinu in the film. And I took a little bit of a interesting diversion to talk about reality and camouflaged reality. Film and acting, and whether it's on stage or on film, is not reality. Today there's a concept called reality TV, right? Reality film, as if it's reality. But, I mean, it's the furthest thing in the world from reality, but as if it's not a script and a story, but they're just going through life and so on. You know, we say that. But generally, staged acting and filmed acting, this is all camouflaged reality. The person who is acting a certain part, that's not him or her, that's the person's playing a part of somebody else, has assumed the role of somebody else. So those who have been to Warsaw remember in the Jewish community cemetery, which is a community cemetery that's over 200 years old. So there's a few gravestones, one next to the other, of what I call the Actors Guild. One of the most famous was Esther Kaminska, and she was the founder of the theater in Warsaw. I'd say the Yiddish theater, but it's superfluous. The Jewish theater was Yiddish. And that's a theater that exists until this very day, where the shows go on, where 90% of the crowd, the audience, are Goyim, and 100% of the actors are Goyim, and you can see Fiddle on the Roof in Yiddish. It's like when you go listening to Italian opera. You know, it's the same. They love it. They love it. They for sure love it. They love Jewish culture. They hate Jews, but they love Jewish culture. In Krakow, there's one restaurant next to the other. You look at the menu. Kishka, Kugel, Cholent. It's Chazer Shrimp.
They know who's coming.
Yeah.
From Warsaw,
Goyim, singing
all the Jewish
politics. The Jewish one, yeah, because they know it. They know it, yeah, okay.
In Yiddish.
So one of the Ida Kaminska, Ida Kaminska was the daughter. I remember Ida Kaminska from New York City. My mother took me once to the Yiddish theater, those who remember, Second Avenue, remember? Yidl Mitten Fiedel. I saw a film starring Ida Kaminska. Right. So I'm talking about this Ida Kaminsky's mother, Esther Kaminska, Esther Rochel Kaminska. So she's got an interesting tombstone. And next to it is a tombstone of another actor, which has a hand hiding the person's face, as if to say, and there are masks all over the matzevot. It's a very, very interesting. And basically, the matzevot in Warsaw were telling the story of the person. That's really what the purpose of the matzevot was. It wasn't just sifting out a pasuk from Tehillim or Mishlei, which you know, can do for so many people. How many people are Ishtam Yirelu Kim Sur Meira? I mean, how many people are there that fit the category, and yet you see 20,000 of them in Ar Menuchot? You know, it's Acharimot Kedoshim Emor, so everybody's Ishtam Yirelu Kim Sur Meira. But they gave a lot of thought to who the person was. The fact is that there is camouflaging of the reality, and the person who plays the role can really have nothing at all to do with the role itself that he or she is playing. The person can be a very good actor. When I saw in New York City two, three years ago, there was an off-Broadway play called The Soul Singer. It was about Shlomo Kalbach. The Shlomo Kalbach was played by a goy. He was terrific. He was absolutely terrific. And there was a movie here made about 10 years ago called Ha'Hezder. It was about a a very right-wing yeshiva tester that ran into all kinds of political things, without getting into the story. The Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Tester in this film was Asi Dayan, the son of Moshe Dayan. I mean, an acclaimed mushat, I mean, a decadent person. He died already, all right? But he was a drug addict and everything. But he played the role of Rosh Yeshiva very, very well. Very, very well. Yeah, okay, Seder. But the fact that that's the point of a good actor. Whoever you may be, you can play somebody else's role. And that's really what the talent is all about. And that's the question about, in a very serious manner, who are we? The Rebbe of Kotsk, his name is Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, who, just to put him in a certain perspective, was the forerunner of Ger. He was the Rebbe of Rabbi Yitzhak Meir Rutenberg, who changed his name then to Alter, and the family of the Ger Rebbes are all Alter family. And he was known by the initials Reish Yud Mem, Rabbi Yitzhak Meir, and that's how his Sfarim are called, the Chidushe HaRim, Rabbi Yitzhak Meir. So the Chidushe HaRim was the grandfather of the Sfat Emet, grandfather. So this is, he was a Talmud of, or Chosid of, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk. So Kotsk is somewhat the forerunner. Rebbe of Kotsk was a very, very, very problematic, or let's just say complex personality. I think a psychiatrist would have a field day. He suffered chronic depression. He withdrew from reality for years. Chassidim were banging on the door to talk to him. He didn't want to open the door for them. He had all kinds of shtick, but he had great lines, one-liners, really phenomenal one-liners that were very piercing and very, very penetrating. But when he always interviewed somebody who wanted to become a chassid, and the first question he asked was, who are you? And mi ata, who are you? And the person would say his name, and he would respond, I didn't ask what your name was. Mi ata. So he would say, you know, I'm a Jew from Warsaw. I didn't ask where you come from. Mi ata, who are you? Well, you know, I'm a shoemaker. Did I ask your profession? I didn't ask your profession. Mi ata. And this went on and on and on until the fellow began to understand that the question of mi ata had something to do with your inner self. Can you define yourself? And the question will always be, against what background do you want me to define myself? Because if you ask my name, it's against the background of everybody else's name. If it's a profession, it's against the background of everybody else's profession. But if you say mi ata, and I'm not interested in your name, location, profession, you know, skin color or hair color, so what exactly are you looking for? But this question, mi ata, the true essence of who you are. Because the Rebbe of Kotsk believed that most of us are living a lie. A lie. We are something, but we're living something else. We're actors. We are all living camouflaged realities. That's what we're doing. And you have to somehow peel away the camouflaged parts in order to get to the bare bones truth of who you are. And until you come to that moment of emet la'amita, absolute truth of who you are, the Rebbe of Kotsk didn't want to look at you. And you had to work on yourself, and you came back with an answer. Who am I? And our Rebbe, the Rav, who did not function at all on Hasidic frequency, quite the contrary, believed that the halakha takes this into consideration as well. If you look at the capital I, Anochi, so he would always refer to the phony I. It means Anochi, that's not real. They're not real. And he says, we sometimes function as a phony I. And he gave certain halachot to prove this. One was called asmachta. The phrase in the Gemara is asmachta lo kanya. I'll translate, I'll explain what this is. The Mishnah tells us, it's a Mishnah that's found twice in Shas, Rosh Hashanah, Mesel Sanhedrin, who might be a disqualified witness to testify. And whether it's in a Beit Din, whether it's under the chuppah, whether it's the sign of get, whatever it is, sometimes we need witnesses who are ksherim le'edut. So we know that relatives are psulei edut. Right? Relatives are invalid. But also, rishaim are invalid. The question is, who's a rasha? So we're not going to stop playing the role of God, who's a tzaddik, who's a rasha, but there are some objective criteria. So if a person violates an avera, that carries with it capital punishment or at least malkot, then that person is defined as a rasha for the purpose of disqualification for edut. For example, cooking meat and milk or eating milk, basam cholov, or wearing shatnis, if a person just violates these averot, then he's disqualified as a witness. A person is a known thief, he's disqualified as a witness, right? A gazlan, a ganav, and so on. But what about the following scenario? Person's a person with, you know, good, fine standing in society. You can certainly conduct business with him without any problems. But he's a little bit of a gambler. That's all, nothing wrong. He goes on Matzah Shabbos to the racetrack, and or he sits with the friends and plays poker, and there's a lot of money on the table. So the Mishnah calls this Misachek Bekubiyah, which means shooting dice, throwing dice, which is gambling, whatever it might be. Whether the game is, but it's a gambling situation. So the Mishnah says a gambler is pasul leidut. Why? Because when you give the... when you win, you're very happy. When you lose, so because of the rules of the game, you're very polite about it, and you forfeit your money to the winner, in the great hope that next game, you're going to be the winner. But the halacha, when it deals with the issue of transfer of ownership, so there's a concept called a kinyan, acquisition. And in a kinyan, there are all different types of kinyanim. Check out first chapter of Masechet Kiddushin in the Mishnah. You get it all, every different type of mode of acquisition and how you can bring it about with a kinyan, whether it's chalipin, whether it's meshicha, whether it's hagba'ah, whether it's kesef, shtar. It's a whole a parsha in itself, kinyanim, acquisitions. But no matter what the mode of acquisition is, there is a necessary prerequisite. The person who's giving up the item is doing it with full intention, and the person receiving the item is doing it with full intention. If there's a question mark about the full intentions of the person giving up the item, then it's not 100% a valid kinyan, mode of acquisition. And the feeling is that in a gambling situation where the loser indeed gives the money in front of everybody, gives his money because he lost the game, but deep down he really didn't want to lose. So the other person is taking it somehow forcefully from the loser. And that means that it's, in Yiddish we say shtinkt, it smells from gezel. And the Gemara calls it avak gezel. It somehow has the sprinklings of gezel. It's not real bona fide theft. Nobody's saying that. But nevertheless, there's something wrong here. And then the Gemara gives another reason why the gambler will be disqualified from saying rendering testimony. Because eino osek biyishuvo shel olam. He's not doing something constructive for society. So the truth is, the question is, what's the difference between the two reasons? Well, it's very simple. If it's because of the first reason, avak gezel, so even if you gambled just once, now you can do tshuva from this. But if you didn't do tshuva from this, you're disqualified as a witness. But if it's the second reason, eino osek biyushuvo shel olam, you're not doing something to promote the welfare of society. Excuse me, I'm a doctor. You know, I'm doing a lot. But Matzah Shabbos, I needed a little bit of an entertainment break with the guys, and we sat down, we played poker. Ma rabba said, what happened? So Gemara says, you're right. That's not something that's going to disqualify you from being a witness. If all it was just a one-shot deal because of entertainment, and it's not something that this is what you do in life. You're not a professional gambler. So there's a difference. So it's interesting, the Rambam takes the first reason, the avak gezel, and hence, just one shot deal of gambling and you're already disqualified. And the authors of the Tosfot, Balei HaTosfot from Ashkenaz, took the second and said only a professional gambler. Now this came up in the late 1970s when Rav Avadya Yosef was then the Sephardi chief rabbi, and he had a radio show, Aseh Lecha Rav, and he would answer questions from the audience, but people would send in notes of Shailo. So the question was, are you allowed to buy the lottery tickets from Mifal HaPayas? So Rav Adya, in a very learned response, goes through the very sugya that I just enumerated, and he says, well, the Ashkenazim can, but the Sephardim can't. That's basically what he said. It was very nice, the show ends, and Rav Adya gets a call from the executive director of the Parat Yosef Yeshiva in the old city, Sfarad Yeshiva, that 80% of the Beit Midrash money came from the Mifal HaPayas, from the national lottery. This Sfarad Yeshiva. And he begged Rav Avadya, he says, what are you going to do? You know, this is all our income for the Beit Midrash. And here you just, with one swipe, wiped out all the Sfarad. This is Sfarad Yeshiva. You know, so as if to say it was built on money that's wrong, you know, so that's immoral and so on, unethical. Rav Avadya didn't have a problem the next week getting on radio and said, I was just in the middle of the shir, but there's a continuation. Brilliant. And he continued to show that the Mifal HaPayas, what you're really doing is donating to Chinuch and Briyut. That's what you're really doing. If you win, you win. If you don't win, you don't win. But nobody really buys the ticket. For that reason, they buy it because it's a donation to educational causes like Parat Yosef Yeshiva and so on. That was absolutely brilliant. Right. So the person's a Rasha. So Rav said, this halacha called asmachta. Asmachta means it looks like you're giving, but you're really not giving. So there's something wrong with the kinyan. And what's really wrong with it? What's wrong with it is your public persona is one thing, but deep inside you're thinking something else. So your revealed look is the phony I. It's not you. It's not you. Yeah, you're giving the money because you lost and you're a gentleman and so on and so on. But it's not the real you. The real you doesn't want to give the money. And this halacha is based on the existence of the phony I. And perhaps even a better example. Better example would be the halacha that both in terms of bringing a korban as well as bringing a korban, let's say, chatat, if a person sinned. So the Torah says, lirtzano, he has to willingly bring the korban. So the Gemara says, "Kofin oto achi omar rotzeani." If a person doesn't want to, so you sit on him, you pressure him until he says, "I want to." And that's very odd because if a person is being pressured, physically pressured, socially pressured, economically pressured, when the person says "rotzeani," what he's really saying is, "All right, enough. You know, just leave me alone. He doesn't want the pressure." Does it really mean that he changed his mind? And the second example is by Gevushin for divorce. Because the divorce has to be done with the full intention and will of the husband to give a get. And if he does not want to give a get, so the Mishnah says, the Gemara says, Kofin oto achi omer rotzeani. You force him. You coerce him. Until he says, I want to give it. So the Rambam says, one second, there's a problem of a get given by coercion. A get delivered by coercion is invalid. It's called get me'usa. So how can this work? Kofin oto achi omer rotzeani. So Rambam says, and this is not the Rav Nachum Mendel from Kutsk, this is the Rambam saying. Rambam says, when you beat the brains out of a guy, however you do it, physically, economically, socially, whatever you do, what you're doing is you're beating down the Yetzer Hara. And the Yetzer Hara is the one that's saying, I don't want, I don't want, I don't want, until the Yetzer Hara gets so weakened that what comes out of his mouth is his Neshama Tohora, saying, Rotzeh Ani. Okay, yeah, I see there's not everybody's going along with this. Not everybody's going along with this. But what the Rav said, this is an example of where the halacha takes into consideration the phony I, as opposed to, I remember when the Rav was saying this in the shir, my brother was looking at me and he goes, what's with the I? I said, no, not I, you know, an okay. Right, the I, the real I, the authentic I, and the phony I, the person who you're not. You're acting. And I this is what I said at the Shir on the Leil Shavuot, that when the Kadosh Baruch Hu opens up, what's his first word? Anochi. Anochi. Now we know that everything that we are taught about a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the Torah has one purpose. It's not to reveal to us what God is. We're never going to know that. Moshe Rabbeinu banging on the door to find out. Hareini nat fodecha, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, Lo yirani ha'adam v'chai. As long as you're a human being that's attached to time and place, the physical surroundings, you're never going to be able to understand the essence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So if you can't understand it anyway, why is a Kadosh Baruch Hu saying this and saying that? So the answer is, number one, Dibra Torah Kilishon B'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in the language that human beings can understand. That's why we talk about the Etzbe Elokim, the finger of God, the Yad Adullah, the Zroa Netuya, all kinds of figures about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, but obviously they're not figures, they're expressions. They have to be understood as in terms of analogy to human things, that, but you know, obviously multiplied to the nth power to about a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So why is a Kadosh Baruch Hu revealing himself if we don't understand it anyway? So the Torah says, "V'halachta b'drachav." It's found in Parshat Ki Tavoh that you have to emulate the ways of God, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu reveals His ways to people. That's the thing. Kadosh Baruch Hu reveals His derech, and that's what the Gemara says: "Mahu rachum, afata rachum; mahu chanun, afata chanun." Just as God is compassionate, you should be compassionate, and so on. So you have all these midot, these characteristics that we are learning from the Torah, from the Nevi'im, from the Ketuvim about a Kadosh Baruch Hu, the way He. He functions in this created world. It's this information is there so that we should emulate, we should copy. And if Kadosh Baruch Hu opens up Aseret HaDibrot with Anochi, it means that we human beings are also supposed to be Anochi, the real self, as the Kotzker Rebbe felt, the real self and not the phony self. Let's not act, let's not play games here, and so on. There was one of the older generation Rosh Hashivas in YU. My brother learned YU for a year, Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, Zichron LeBracha. He was a very big Talmid Chacham. He studied by the Rav's uncle in Brisk, but he was a little bit sharp and a little offbeat and a very zealot for the yeshiva world. He was teaching in YU and wasn't very comfortable about it, let's put it this way. But he was an absolutely phenomenal maggid shir. He knew I'd give a shir. But he wasn't comfortable in the institution that he was teaching, which I felt was a little bit tragic. So he once he was very cynical also. So he once said that it's very easy to fool others being a Lithuanian Litvak Rosh Hashiva, but it's very difficult to fool others being a Hasidish Rebbe. Why? Why is this easy, this difficult? Just because how can you fool somebody? You want to fool somebody, you're a very top-notch Litvisha Rosh Hashiva. So you go to the Mir Yeshiva, you put on a big black hat, you wear a kapota, you wear a long black coat, you know, Bekesh is the Chassidim, the kapota, and you grow the Litvisha payas, you know, and you take a shtender, and you open up a baba kama, and you start shaking, you go with the finger, and you can fool everybody, fine, people don't know anything. You make you, as in Yiddish we say, you machzach. You looks like a fine. So this is easy. You can fool somebody, but why is it difficult to fool somebody being a chassidish rebbe? So Rav Gerelik says, well, what can you do? You can open up a shtibul. You're going to start making a. You're going to have your shtreimel and your bekesher. You're going to make a tish for shalashudis, as zulash lishit, right? He says that's not faking it. That's it. So he said it's hard to fake it. So it's easy to fake being a Litvisha Rosh Hashiva. It's hard to fake being upset. That's somebody coming from a thoroughbred Litvak. You got to understand that. That's the idea of who are we. And sometimes, there's even a Gemara, I forget where it is exactly, but it talks about two of the Tanaim or Amoraim that got a glimpse of what's going on in the other world. Me'achorei ha-pargod, the other world. And he comes back and he reports. They said, what did you see? He said, olam hafuchu. It's an upside-down world. What he meant to say was, we think they are tzaddikim and they're not. And we think they are rishoyim and they're not. Olam hafuchu. And we don't have a clue who a person really is. Because sometimes we judge opinions by the way they look. We had this once with our great Rebbe Rabbi Lichtenstein Zatzal. So he was so out of sync with everything that looked like a Rosh Hashiva, you know, modern suits, clean shaven, till the very end and so on. I remember in the 70s where he still would go to the army bases, the 70s, 80s, he'd go to the army bases to visit the yeshiva guys with some of his younger ramen. So the younger guys, you know, all have beards and so on. So they come to the army base, and this 18-year-old chayal at the gate called the Shin Gimel, you know, he says, we're here to see the Talmidim. So he says, all right, the Rabbanim will go in and the driver will stay outside. until they had explained to him who the driver was. Because these are stereotyped. Stereotyped, that's all. They don't know. They don't know. They don't know. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was once at a wedding. The only time I was at 770, he had a Talmud from YU who became Lubavitch, who invited Rav Lichtenstein to the wedding. And there was a parade of Rabbanim who got brachot under the chuppah. Everybody was Harava Gaon, Harava Gaon, Harava Gaon. They called up Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Harav Aaron Lichtenstein. Say that, I mean, those of us knew that he was the only Gaon from all of them put together. We all knew that. And Rav Aaron couldn't care less. That for sure. But why did that happen? Why? Because, clean shaven and some modernish, like. I once sat and sing next to Rav Mital once at a wedding, and everybody was being called up, Harava Gaon, Rava Gaon. He says, I didn't know we came, but we're back to the Tkufat Gaonim. If you put it as Harava Gaon, it's amazing. So, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Now, this explanation that I offer, that Anochi Hashem Elokecha is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the absolute Anochi. There's no foamy I by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's Anochi. That most probably gives us to understand the second Dibur. Lo yelcha Elohim Achirim al Panai. Al Panai. The Parashamim have difficulty with the word al Panai. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have a face. So what does it mean? Lo yelcha Elohim Achirim al Panai. If I translate this now in human terms, don't put a false deity as a mask over me. That's what it means, as a mask. Your mask, you want your religiosity to masquerade as a Kadosh Baruch Hu, but it's somebody else? That's not Anochi. That's not Anochi. And even if you say, but one second, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still with me on this. No. There's a concept called Avodah Zarah B'Shituf. Avodah Zarah in partnership, which means you believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you believe that there are other divinities around sharing the platform. That's Avodah Zarah. And that's why the Rambam felt Christianity was Avodah Zarah. There's a dispute on this, by the way. But the Rambam believed that the Trinity, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, the Av Ben Ruach HaKodesh, is really a divisibility of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if Yeshu is an incarnation of God on this world, that's already Avodah Zarah, according to the Rambam. And that's why, according to the Rambam, while you might be allowed to walk into a mosque because they believe in monotheism, Christianity, the Rambam says you're not allowed to walk into a church because it's a Beit Avodah Zarah. It's amazing the difference between this and that. Now you have to realize the Rambam was sitting in North Africa. We didn't really have to deal with Christians. And even when he was in Spain before 13 years old, he also didn't have to deal with Christians yet. He was in the southern part of Spain, which was was Muslim Spain. But the Gedolei Yisrael of Europe saw it a little bit differently, and they had no other recourse but to modify their understanding of Christianity because they were living in Christian countries. So they came down, let's just say, less hard on Christianity than the Rambam. So lo yelecha Elohim achirim al panai is the theory of Avodah Zarah. The theory. It's not a detail. The detail comes a little later. Lo tase lecha pesel, source number one. Lo tase lecha pesel v'chol tmuna, psalim, statues, pictures. These are details. That you now have forms and pictures and drawings of celestial bodies, of other things, and you make them into a god. So there are many, many details of the laws of Avodah Zarah. And just glance down to source number five for a second. Source number five, we're not going to read this whole source, but I just brought it to you so that you can just be impressed. Every single section in the Mishneh Torah of the Ramban begins with a headline, and then he gives you, before he even starts talking, he gives you a type of index of all the mitzvot he's going to deal with in this particular section. So it could be one mitzvah, it could be five mitzvot, it could be 10 mitzvot, but 10 mitzvot is already a lot in a particular section. Usually it's 5, 6, 7, whatever it is. I didn't do exact mathematical survey, but just my own learning, I can tell you that if there are 10 mitzvot, that's already a lot. But some have 15, some have 20 even. The winner, the gold medal, is Avodah Zarah. It has 51 mitzvot. 51 of the 613 is all jam-packed into one section which forms one kovetz of the first book of Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. It's unbelievable. It's a you know, 51 out of 613, in terms of the percentage of all of the Torah, is all completely packed into this action-packed perek called Hilchot Avodah Zarah. And what's interesting is that it's called, it's typed out here, Hilchot Avodah Zarah, and that's how the Bar Ilan printout puts it out. And why is that so important to know? Because in most standard editions of the Rambam, it says Hilchot Avodat Kochavim Umazalot. That's what it says. And that was a censor. When the Rambam's text came to Europe, they were very nervous every time the Rambam used the word Nochri, a stranger, which meant either Nochri or Goy. They simply took out the word Goy or Nochri and they printed Avod Akum, an abbreviation, Ayin Kav Vav Mem, Avodat Kochavim Umazalot, which means idol worshippers and astrologers. Idol worshippers and astrologers. Chevra, our wonderful Christian neighbors, we don't mean you. We don't mean you. That was the official Torah Shebichtav, the written Rambam. Of course, the oral Rambam was, we mean you. But we don't mean you, right? Akum, akum. Avodat kochavim mazalot. So where the printers in Europe had these directives from the Rabbanim. That if it says Abu Dazara, print Akum. If it says Nochri, print Akum. If it says Goy, print Akum. So there's one particular section in Luchot Melachim where in the manuscripts it reads Goy Shelo Avad Avodah Zarah. What's the halacha? How do we relate to a Goy who does not serve Avodah Zarah? So how is it printed? Akum Shelo Avad Akum. It's absurd even. Because the Bocha Azetza just, you know, did what he had to do. It was a word processing. If it said Goy, you print Akum. If it says Avodah Zarah, you print Akum. So Goy Shelo Avad Avodah Zarah shows up as Akum Shelo Avad Akum, which doesn't make sense, right? But that's why you have to know. Now, where do we know all these deletions? From the Yemenite text, Rav Kapach Zatzal in Yemen never had to worry about Christianity. And the Yemenite Rambam texts were never doctored up. So when the Yemenites brought these texts to Eretz Israel, all of a sudden, you know, will the real Rambam please stand up? And some of these Yemenite texts were verified. It's not the only verifiable text, but they certainly helped. So they adopted that in the Bar Ilan project to use the Rambam that was uncensored, the uncensored Rambam. So it says Rambam Hilchot Avodah Zarah Hagdama, the introduction. Hilchot. And take a look what happened here. Hilchot Avodat Kochavim v'chukotehem. So in the Bar Ilan, because I didn't type anything here. This comes straight out of the computer, and apparently here the Bar Ilan computer is still using an old text. Hilchot Avodat Kochavim v'chukotehem. Yesh bechalalan nun aleph mitzvot. The 51 mitzvot. Shtei mitzvot tasei, two positive mitzvot, and 49 mem tet mitzvot lo tasei. V'zeo pirtan. And here's the details. So you have now all kinds of averot that some of them you might not even believe are directly related to Avodah Zarah, like tattooing number 49 on the bottom, Shelo Lichtof Karkoa, the idea that you're not allowed to, in mourning, you're not allowed to scratch yourself to let yourself bleed. That's called Lo Tegodedu. And rip out your hair. So the people used to do this. There was an anguish. They would rip out the hair. But that's only if somebody still has something left to rip out. Some people, it's not shaykh. You know, that's not relevant. But, yeah.
In Poland, when we went to several of the Tate Knesset, they had the Simone of the Zodiac.
Right.
I remember that.
Correct.
Does that mean in
the
Yom
Kippur
ritual,
you
won't see that?
The Rambam also was keenly aware of the zodiac, but he believed that there was the only thing you have there is symbolism, but no superpowers, astrological powers. As opposed to Ramban, 100 years after the Rambam, he believed there were astrological powers, but they did not affect Am Yisrael. The world at large is governed by astrological powers, according to Ramban. Where the celestial bodies are in position can affect human action, or what happens to human beings as individuals and collectively as a nation. The Gemara says, "Ein mazal li Yisrael, There's no mazel. There was a Rav in Be'er Sheva, Rav Katz, so every time he came to a wedding in Bar Mitzvah, people said mazel tov, he rejected it out of hand. Ein mazel li Yisrael. What do you tell him, mazel tov? What do you mean, good luck? Luck, it's not a factor. What kind of mazel tov? I mean, it's not a terrible thing to say, but certainly the fact that the Zohar says Hakol Talui B'Mazal Afilu Sefer Torah She'Beichal, so you see, Mazal is used. It's used in the Midrashim. It's used in the later writings and so on. The Rambam was against it. The Rambam believed that all astrological power, the belief in astrological powers, is Avodah Zarah. He believed it, but not everybody believed it. So the zodiac, the Rambam was aware of the fact that there were, you know, the 12 constellations and so on. He was aware of this, but he didn't believe that they had powers, that they had any particular above human powers, supernatural powers. The Rambam here has in number 45, Mem Hei and Mem Vav, the Isur, the prohibition of removal of peyot with a razor. Removal of peyot with a razor and the removal of one's facial hairs with a razor. Right? That's the whole business why you're allowed to shave with an electric shaver. Those that are not do not function like a razor, but rather function like a scissors, which is a double edge. The Rabbanim of 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago wrote about this already, why the electric shaver, at least many models of it, would be okay. But I remember growing up that there were some companies you couldn't use it. And even here, there's a Machon Tzomet gives out a whole list of which electric shavers are kosher, you know, because of this. But anyway, what does this have to do with Avodah Zarah? So the Rambam believed that the priests of old, of the pagan cults, would actually have this kind of a haircut, this kind of a shaving, and in order to remove ourselves socially as far as possible, so we were like doubled over backwards, and we would not even think of having that kind of a haircut style, or that kind of a shaving style, and so on. So that's why the Rambam says it's part of Avodah Zarah. Yeah, Rivka? Chav Zayin is Shalola Kimatseva, right. So this doesn't mean Shalola Kimatseva doesn't mean you can't put up a matseva at a gravestone. That's not what it means at all. Right, for sure not. It has to do with setting up a type of, as opposed to Mizbeach. So you find sometimes in the Torah that the offering of korbanot, sacrificial activity, was done on an altar, that's a Mizbeach, and sometimes on a stone. Just it wasn't really a formal Mizbeach. So that's a matseva. So, in other words, you might say, all right, what's the difference if I put up a mizbeach? I'm not doing anything, no harm done. So the Torah, many times, I'll take a step back. We usually think that when the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avot, Asu Siyag da Torah, put a fence around the Torah, it means that the Torah prohibits X, but now the Chachamim are drawing a circle called Y, which is a wider parameter, so that we get used to not transgressing the wider parameter. For sure we'll never ever get close to the inner parameter, which is the biblical violation. That's the way we understand the rabbinic prohibitions. The Torah, according to the Torah, you're not allowed to write two letters on Shabbat. You're not allowed to write two letters on Shabbat. So Chachamim said, by the way, you're not allowed to write even one letter on Shabbat. I'm not going to get into why the definition of writing on Shabbat is defined by two letters, but that's the way it is. It's defined as two letters. But Chazal say, don't even write one letter. Why? Because write one letter, you might run another one, then you're ready. And not only that, but the pen and the pencil is muksa. You don't even move it. By the way, there's no iser of touching a pen or pencil on Shabbat. There's no iser negiyah. There's an iser of tiltot. You're not to move it. Because if you train yourself not to move a pencil or pen on Shabbat, you're certainly not going to write it. You're not going to write. So these are called siyag da Torah. With Pesach, we have so many. That's we understand it in so many areas of halacha. But it might be novel to hear that the Torah itself is based on such a system of a core nucleus avera, and around it, the Torah already builds fences with regard to not eating chametz on Pesach. There are plenty of fences around it. that are all biblical. Because the core isur, the core provision, is not to eat a kezayit of chametz on Pesach. But the first orbit around it is don't eat even a minuscule of chametz on Pesach. And not only that, but on Erev Pesach you better get rid of it. And if you don't get rid of it, you can have two aveirot just by having it in possession. These are all outer orbits, all in the Chumash. All in the Chumash. These are not rabbinic add-ons at all. And so too with regard to Avodah Zarah. The Torah does not want you lo yir lecha Elohim achirim al panai. But in order not to get to there, that's you know the dangerous step of Avodah Zarah, take a few miles back and don't do this and don't do that and don't do this and don't do that. Don't even come close to all the issues that were set up then by Rabbanim as well with regard to milk and wine from Goyim and so Stam Yenam and so. Not to have parties with Goyim because they were worried this is going to lead to assimilation. Exactly what happens, unfortunately. So these are the 51 mitzvot in the Torah that have to do with Avodah Zarah. It's unbelievable. Now, with regard to Pesel and Tumunah, so I remember, I'm seeing now on the buses pictures of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal, because his Yahrzeit is coming up soon. So there's going to be some type of, in Har Menuchot, some type of event. So I remember when I was in the Amuna College in the 80s, in the 90s. So many of our students there would study graphic art. And they also had a department of fine art. And in these departments, they did various drawings. They did pesel, pisul, which is forming statues and so on. So how can you do all that in light of the pasuk, lo tasalcha pesel v'chol tmunah? So let's jump back to 1925. I wasn't around 1925, but 1925, when photography, it was developed before 1925, but the Chofetz Chaim was asked in 1925 about photography. If it's out of sync with Lo Tasalecha Pesel V'Chol Tmunah, maybe you're not allowed to take pictures, photographs, because you're not allowed to have pictures. It says Tmunah. What's a Tmunah? So the Chofetz Chaim shows from a Gemara, and we'll get to it in a few minutes, why these pictures that are printed on paper are not the tmunah that the Torah had in mind. And but he doesn't see any value why anybody would even want to have a tmunah. Now, there is a famous picture of the Chofetz Chaim that is known. Some people say he only was forced to do it because of an internal passport. He had to have a picture. It's not true. When I visited Melbourne, Australia, and I met the late Rav of the Mizrahi community, Rav Abramnik, Zichron Lebracha, he was a distant relative of the Chofetz Chaim, and he showed me in his family photo albums pictures, family pictures of the Chofetz Chaim sitting around holding children, pictures of the Chofetz Chaim. I mean, he was a real person, and you know, he shows up in family photos. So that's for sure. But I also have a book. When I went to the Yeshiva Chofetz Chaim in Midtown Manhattan, so I remember once getting some type of a prize, probably was for collection of Chinuch Atzmai money, whatever it was. You collected a certain amount, you got a sefer. So what was the sefer? It was Kitvei Chofetz Chaim, the selected writings of the Chofetz Chaim. But there were a handful of pictures there that were beyond the picture, famous picture of the Chofetz Chaim that has been doctored up with color now. Believe me, 1925. Chofetz Chaim died in 33 at age 90-something. But they didn't have color of photography there in 1925. But today, with computer technology, you can put all the color, you can make them look nice and tan and everything beautiful. So that picture has been doctored up. But these were photos of Chofetz Chaim sitting with his son. You can see it. You can see it's Chofetz Chaim and so on. But the most exciting piece of photography of Chofetz Chaim I ever saw in my life was just last year. Somebody posted on the internet a clip from 1923 walking into the Knesia Gedola of Agudat Yisrael in Vienna, and there it is for 8 full seconds. It was the Chofetz Chaim walking. I watched it over and over and over again. Because, you know, I once taught in the Mechlelet Lifshitz, and I taught my teachers there, who were women who were doing Hishtalmut Morim or Hishtalmut Morot, women are on the Shabbaton year and teaching and you know, learning for add a degree or upgrade their degree, whatever it was. And I mentioned something that I said, my grandfather actually heard the Chofetz Chaim speak once. And this woman says, your grandfather? So the Chofetz Chaim was in Rashi's time. I said, no, Chofetz Chaim wasn't in Rashi's time. Chofetz Chaim died in 33. I mean, the Mishnah Berurah already came out in 1865. The Orach HaShulchan that came out in 1880s quotes the Mishnah Berurah already. All right, b'seder. But the man is also a 20th century, early 20th century personality, and shows up on film, and he was real, you know. He walked a very short man, right? No different than Rav Moshe Feinstein. Those of you who knew Rav Moshe.
Oh.
I remember Rabbi Tendler, my great teacher, who was Rav Moshe's son-in-law, who once said, he says, you know, my shver, we always talked about my shver, my father-in-law, he says, my shver was, you know, was a short man, but, you know, he'd never make it in the NBA, but he was a giant. And he was a giant. And he certainly was a giant. There's no question about that. So, the Tmunot, the Rav Chofetz Chaim said, that he didn't think anything real of why we need photography. So somebody mentioned to him, he says, you know, maybe it'll be important in 50 years for the world to see what a Chofetz Chaim looked like. And he agreed to be photographed. He bought the argument that there is something to this. There is something to it. Maybe in 50 years somebody's going to be impressed. And I'll tell you, when I saw that little film clip there, there's something to that. There really is, to see what the Chofetz Chaim was. And by the way, Chofetz Chaim at that conference on day one walked out on the conference because one of the speakers started speaking against Rav Kook. And Chofetz Chaim said, I didn't come here to hear Lashon Hara, and he walked out. He walked out. See? That's what happened. And now at that conference, by the way, is when Rav Meir Shapira from the Rav of Lublin and Chachmei Lublin Yeshiva introduced the idea of the Daf HaYomi learning. That's where it happened. Vienna, 1923. Okay. So that's with regard to Tmuna. So what happened with our students in the Muna College? So Rav Mordechai Eliyahu came for an official visit. He was then Rav Roshi. And I had the young girls put together questions which we submitted to Rav Eliyahu up front. So at least that's not a good idea to surprise people. Let him come prepared and he'll think it out, whatever he wants to say. So the one question was about the Department of Sculpture. Pisul, how are we gonna do this? So the truth is, he referred to the Gemara, Masechet Rosh Hashanah. Turn the page on source number 7. The source really begins with the Mishnah that they were in the office of Rabbi Gamliel. It says the mud tzurot levana hayu lo l'Rabbi Gamliel betavla ubekotel ba'aliyato. Aliyato means a second floor. A tall building means it had a second floor. That was a skyscraper. Second floor. So his lishka, his office, and he was the nasi, was upstairs, and he had like a board, a luach, a table, like tavla. One Hebrew use it, a tabla, and a kotel, and he had forms. Of the moon. Why? Because when the witnesses for Kiddush LaChodesh would come, he would ask them, did you see it like this? Did you see it like this? You know the point. Because astronomically, the moon would show up only in a certain way. And he would be able to gauge from the description of the witnesses whether they were on the level or they were lying. So that's what it says. Shebehen mara'et hedyotot. He would ask those witnesses, plain people who would come, Vomer hakazeh ra'ito, kazeh. Did you see it this way? Did you see it that way? How did you see the moon? On this, the Gemara jumps on the Mishnah and says, 1 second. How could he have models of the moon? This is asur. It's a avodah zara. You know. And gets into the whole discussion about whether you're allowed to have figures of the moon or figures of the sun. After a whole back and forth, if you look in the middle where it's underlined, it says, Tanya, Abaita says, Kol ha-partzufot mutarim chutz mi-partzuf adam. You're actually allowed to have pictures and sculptures of all types of faces of animals, except for the human being. The human being, that's off limits. And the reason is because man was created b'tzelem Elokim. So it's not that you're making a picture of God, but because man's image is B'tzelem Elokim, so hands off, not to do pictures of and psalim and sculptures of human beings. But then the Gemara continues and says there was a shul out there in Bavel that had an andarta, which we use in modern Hebrew too, which means stand up of a monument, that also had And the question is, and you see great Amoraim daven there. Nobody said anything. So obviously nobody said anything. It was permissible. So sometimes from the reality of life, we see that, you know, the theory that they're kicking around the Beit Midrash is not in sync with reality. So then in the Beit Midrash, they have to give answers. You know, how were they able to do this? How were they able to do that? So there are all kinds of answers that were suggested. One is that the sculpture or the picture was incomplete. Incomplete. Because if something was designed for pagan activity, the last thing the pagans would do was use something incomplete. It would be like a slap in the face to the god. So if it was incomplete, it was thrown into the garbage, right? It was not used for religious ritual in any way or manner. And let's just jump, open another window in the computer language, try to remember where I am. With wine. So if wine was used for religious ritual, and I'm not talking about Kiddush and Avdallah, but let's say in a church, the wine was actually used, so that wine is hereby forbidden to a Jew not only to drink, but to derive any monetary benefit from this wine. It's asur b'hana'ah, that's for sure. But what about stam yenam? Stam yenam means wine of a goy. Now, he didn't use it for ritual. All he did was he touched it. He put his hands on it. So you know the Jews won't drink that kind of wine. The wine has to have a heksha on it, and has to be sealed and double sealed and so on. Mesenda, and there's some places that won't have non-Jewish waiters even pour the wine for this reason. But you've heard of the concept called Yayin Mevushel, cooked wine. What's Yayin Mevushel? And Mevushel means that the wine was then cooked up. Now why would they even boil up wine today? Pasteurization, by the way. Wines up. Not all wines are pasteurized, but most are. And a wine that's pasteurized has a din of mevushel. And Chazal never said that yayin mevushel is forbidden from a goy. Why? Because yayin mevushel was always low quality wine. And the goy would never dare use such wine. It would be an insult to bring that wine into the temple. So that's why yayin mevushel was 100% okay. Because there's something wrong with it. Something wrong with it. Rav Goren had a big to-do with the fact that whether all pasteurizations create a mevushel situation. He believed yes, and some other rabbanim said no, the temperature has to be higher than the process of pasteurization to consider it mevushel. So there was a big machloket between Rav Goren and other rabbanim here in Eretz Yisrael 20 years ago, 30 years ago, what's considered yayin mevushel. We'll get back now to pictures and sculptures. So if they're incomplete, so then it's okay. So I assured Rav Baruch Eliyahu, all my students, it's always incomplete. Never complete. Never mushlam. You don't have to worry about it. But he says, look, maybe, they can, if they're doing a picture of a face, so leave the one of the ear off or half of the ear. Something should be noticeably incomplete. Rav Kook Zatzal wrote a letter of a bracha to the Bezalel School of Art when it opened its doors in 1908. And there he writes that this is a great, great scene for Yerushalayim, that Yerushalayim, which lost its splendor, we know Yerushalayim has 70 names, and one of the names is Klilat Yofi, the epitome of beauty. The epitome of beauty. But unfortunately, because of galut and neglect and shmama, it lost it. So Rav Kook said, we, as part of reclaiming Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, have to beautify it. And I had a lot of confidence that the Bezalel School of Art would train Jewish artists in the area of aesthetic feeling, that we would be able to beautify Yerushalayim. And he gave an example. He says, there was a 2.5-year-old, 2 or 3-year-old baby girl, sick, very sick, and she's so sick, she can't get out of bed, she can't play, she's just totally exhausted and so on. And everybody's very worried. She's running a high fever, and doctors don't know what to do. And then finally, there's a turn for the better. Something's looking better. What happened? The girl asked for her doll. She bichata buba. She asked for a doll. And everybody's happy. Now, the doctor knew she's not out of the woods yet, and the mother knew it's not over yet. But there was a turnaround. The fact that her mood changed, and she wanted her doll back, that's a very good simon that she's on the right direction. Rav Kook said, the opening of the Bezalel School of Art is the Yerushalayim asking for her buba, asking for her doll back. That's the way he saw it. Truth is, I mean, Rav Kook was a visionary. Bezalel School of Art turned out to be a very, very... fine school of art now connected to the Hebrew University, but I'm not 100% sure if it fulfilled the mission and the mandate that Rav Kook had in mind back in 1908. But he deals in that three-page bracha letter with the issue of pisul, and he says not to give up on absolute artistic perfection. And therefore, he said, if you're going to do statues of human faces, you should do it 99.9% and have a Shabbos Goy completed. You should have a non-Jewish artist. Because while a non-Jew is forbidden to serve Avodah Zarah, per se, the non-Jew does not have all these around and around prohibitions that Am Yisrael have in terms of preventing Avodah Zarah. And therefore, he says, we would be able to use the good services of a non-Jewish artist to do that finishing touch to make it into a perfect object. And what's interesting, I think the lesson of Rav Kook, as opposed to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, was willing to say, all right, so it's not going to be perfect, you know, that's what the Gemara says to do, that's what we do, and, you know, Shalom Yisrael. But Rav Kook was hypersensitive to art, to art and music. He spells it out in different places. And he did not want a 99% product. He wanted a 100% product, but not to transgress the halakha. So let's do it with a Shabbos guy, and we'll get the job done. I think that's absolutely fascinating. There's another at the last line of source number 7 also tells us lehitlamed avad dichtiv lo tilmad laasot aval ata lomed lavinu lorot. Sometimes something might be prohibited, but in the context of education, it becomes permissible. Why would somebody want to be educated? Because you might be in a scenario that you have to give a decision, is somebody doing something wrong or not? In order to decide if somebody is doing something wrong or not, you have to know what the wrong is. So let's assume somebody is a dayan, somebody is a judge, and he's going to sit on a beit din of 23 dayanim, judging somebody for idolatry worship. And the dayan doesn't have a clue what it means to be an idolatrous worshiper. How can he judge somebody? So obviously he's going to have to read up on it. He's going to have to read those books. So the Rambam tells us that when the Mishnah says in the last chapter of Masechet Sanhedrin, there it says, Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelik l'olam haba. Every Jew has a share in olam haba. It's a great saying. There's only one catch. The next Mishnah, the Elu She'ein Lahem Chelik, and those who don't, then it's a long, long list. So then it says there, Rabbi Akiva says, Af HaKorei Misfarim Chitzonim. Even though included of those who lose the forfeit, the Olam Haba, people who read from the extraneous books. What are the Sfarim Chitzonim? Today when we talk about Sfarim Chitzonim, we're talking about Sfarim that are not part of Tanakh, but somehow look like Tanakh, but they're products of Bayit Sheni. The book of Sefer HaMakabim, the Sefer of Chochmat Ben Sira, that the Gemara itself quotes once in a while. There are all kinds of books there. Yehudit, Megillot, and so on. They're not part of Tanakh, and we don't use them for ritual reading in a shul, but they can be read. It's not any worse than reading the Yediot Achronot. It's history. These are history books. No, I'm serious. So that's what it means, Sfarim Chitzonim. So Rabbi Avadya Mibar Tanura, the great Parshan on the Mishnah, says it means the writings of Aristotle. Okay, it means the philosophical works of the Greeks. Well, would the Rambam, you know, drink to that? Of course not. The Rambam read Aristotle. He was pretty much of an expert in Aristotle. The Rambam says it refers to books of idolatrous practice. But those people who have to know the material, so for them it's a mitzvah to read it. Look, I'm going to tell you something, but I'm going to predicate by saying I'm the last of the tzaddikim, all right? So don't get me wrong here. And I will watch a ball game once in a while because, you know, as the Gemara said, the Gemara says in Maseret Sanhedrin, Daf Kuf Bet, that Menashe, the son of Chizkiah Melech, who Chizkiah made this great religious reform in Eretz Yisrael, was the big Baal Magid, Machzir B'Tshuvah, and his son Menashe brings it all back, all the Avodas are all back. So Menashe comes to a dream and to one of the Tanaim, and he says, you had such a father, Chizkiah, what happened to you? And his response was, you know, big talker, if you would have been in my generation, you would have picked up your kapota and run to Avodah Zarah also. And I always say this in connection with, anybody who grew up in the 50s and 60s in New York City didn't go to Yankee Stadium, so he was on McCarthy's list of un-American activities. Right? you grew up in a certain environment and everybody's there and Rabbanim are there and Bnei Yeshiva are there and Chassidim are there and Misnagdim, as long as you're rooting for the Yankees. That was important. There was Achdus, you know, it was real Achdus there. So, I remember when I was in doing Miluim. My Miluim was the best Miluim in the world. I was giving Shurim in the Air Force. You can't get a better Miluim because I like to give Shurim and I like to look at airplanes. So the venue was right and everything was right about it. So I remember once I was there for Yom Iyun. And the night before, and there it wasn't just to give a shiur in a Beit Knesset where there'd be generally Chayalim Datiyim, but it was before Yom Tov, or even before Tisha B'Av, or for Rosh Hashanah. I'd give 6 shiurim to different places on the base, and more often than not, the Chayalim there were not religious. Ketzinim, officers, and so on, which is wonderful, because you get an opportunity to share word of Torah to Am Yisrael. So, the night before, there was a very big basketball game of Maccabi Tel Aviv. So I remember watching the game. For one reason, I'm not a big fan of Maccabi Tel Aviv at all, because as I told my students in Chashmonaim, Maccabi Tel Aviv, Mickey Berkovich, I mean, I saw the Gedolim, I saw Will Chamberlain and Bill Russell, I saw the Gedolim, you know, don't tell me about these Maccabi Tel Aviv guys. These guys are midgets, you know, like they don't have to play basketball. But I watched the game anyway, because a lot of times in a sports game, you can see something that can trigger a discussion that you really want to talk about. And you know that if you come in, you start saying, you know, your opening word is, you know, it says in this week's parsha, everybody's already sleeping. So, you see the game last night? Wow. It was really great. And all of a sudden, oh, you saw it? Yeah, sure, of course I saw it, you know. And then we talk about 5 minutes of Bittul Torah, which is not Bittul Torah. It's the entree into. My wife said I had to say Birkas HaTorah before I watched the game. Because she knew what I was doing. And sometimes, you know, a big play or the value of a split second, you know, where it came out almost, and all kinds of scenarios on the basketball court that you can then use as a trigger to get into what you want to talk about. Oh, you want to talk about Nila? You want to talk about Nila, right? You want to make sure they go to Shul on Nila and talk about the idea of the last second possibility and the game was won in the last second in a jump shot, you know? You got it. It's tailor-made. It's really tailor-made. And that's what the Gemara says. Sometimes you're reading something that is completely prohibited to read, except that you're doing it L'Shem Shamayim, because you know that the experiences that you're reading about will come in handy when you have to promote the Torah. And the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, Da Masha Tashiv L'Apikairis. You should know how to answer somebody who's a heretic. Now, if you don't know what he's talking about, if you're not on his wavelength, you're never going to respond to him. You'll never be able to do it. Hence, here, you have to really get into that way of life. So I'll just end with, and it's already overtime, but I remember Shlomo Kalbach, Alav Shalom, was filmed one of his last years on Hashanah Rabbah, and he was explaining why the lulav and esrog, we shake 6 different directions. So, you know, 4 directions, I understand there's 4 directions, but why do we do up and down? There was a big Kiddush that he said, why do we do up and down? Of course, if you're into aviation, if you know how to fly a plane, you know that there's 6 different directions. Because not only do you have all 4 directions, but you have also this way. And you have to know that. So, but the Shlomo said that it really has to do with going down and saving neshamot. Sometimes we have to go down, as the Torah says, Ani Hashem HaShochen Itam B'toch Tum Otam. You have to really go down. But not everybody is capable of going down. You can't go down until you first go up. You have to go up and be touched by Kedusha. You have to be touched by Torah. You have to be touched and totally enveloped by the world of what the Torah is all about. And when you're that kind of stuff, that which inoculates you for the world of down, then and only then can you go down. And you can't say, no, I don't want to go down. I'm going to get contaminated. No. Remember a great rabbi in America, Rabbi Joseph Lichtenstein, Zechar Lebracha, told us once, the Kohen in Beit HaMikdash, who would be asked by somebody Tamei to sprinkle the Efer Parah Adumah, so the Kohen becomes Tamei in the process. Can you imagine every Tamei, every person coming to get the sprinkling of the Parah Adumah, every Kohen runs away. I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this. I'm going to be Tamei because of him. the halacha is, yeah, if to save a Jew, to bring him out of his tumah, sometimes you have to become tumah in the process also. And that's part of the price that you pay for being a Kohen on duty in Beit HaMikdash. And that's what Rosh Shlomo was saying. If you go up, don't stay up. Sometimes you have to go down also. So if you have to watch a ball game to do it, so you watch a ball game to do it. And it's also something. Okay, so that's Beseda. Okay, before we just break, next week, because I'm in love with the airports and stuff like that, I won't be here. I have my Poland, my annual Poland trip. So Phil Trinovsky or somebody's going to pinch it for me. It will be a shear at this time, but it won't be me. Okay?
And she told us to Rabbi Gronis' story that when he just said there was a guy who was going in and out. One of the Talmidim was going in and out of the room.